My name is Betty Curdy, and I'm an Al-Anon. Good morning, everyone.
Hello.
For you who have been asking me, are you nervous? Yes, I am. And before I forget my manners, I want to thank the committee for asking me to share my experience, strength, and hope this morning. This is the second time that I've had the honor to share at homecoming. My husband has a little resentment because he came for treatment here and he has not been asked. But I told him they usually ask the sicker members of the family. I've also been asked several questions this past week that they say I never give the answer to, so I'll try to give the answers this morning. One of the questions is, why didn't you leave home? Well, the reason I didn't leave home was that everybody that I would have gone to was living with me. Both my parents were living with me. They were both invalids. My father was paralyzed from the top of his head to the tip of his toes, and for 10 years we waited on him, we bathed him, we dressed him, we fed him, we did whatever needed to be done. Katie and I did it. For better than 2 years, my mother was paralyzed from the waist down and did not walk, or she was bedridden, and I learned to give her massages on her body. And she did learn to sort of walk and shuffle. I had 3 children in 3.5 years. The next year and a half, I lost 2. And I had a sister-in-law who is diagnosed as a schizophrenic who stayed up all night and slept all day that lived with me. And any other relatives that did not have any place to go came to my house. Hub drank, and I bitched. You know, so we didn't either one have any place to go, and we just hung in there together. If we stay together till the 17th of this month, we will be married 41 years. And the miracle and the magic of this marriage is we still enjoy being together. The majority of the time where you see one of us, you see both of us. Now, someone asked me the other night in a meeting, says, do y'all ever argue? And he just sits there and hangs his head a little bit, and I said, well, we may not argue, but we have healthy discussions. So that's sort of the way it goes. I'm happy today. I'm contented in my skin today, and there was a time that I was not. I'm going to share with you some things during the drinking days that happened. I'm not proud of these, nor am I ashamed anymore. There was a time that I carried a lot of shame and guilt, but I don't do that now. These are the things that brought me to Al-Anon, and I'm grateful that I'm in this program, because you see, this program saved my life, it saved my home, it saved my family, and it gave me a God of my understanding that I don't believe that I could have found anywhere else. I lived in Atlanta, and I was going to high school. I knew I did not want to go to college, nor could my parents afford for me to go to college at the time. And at that time, you could go to school in the mornings and work in the afternoons, and that's what I did. Now, this is where I met my husband. The majority of you all know that I call him Cody. I've been calling him Cody for 42 years now, and it's just hard for me to change. And when we went to work at our present job, one of his requests is that I call him Herb. Well, I do sometimes, but that's hard for me to do, but I'm trying to change. That's one of the changes that I'm trying to make, and I slip and slide with that. And he's 3 years older than I am, and he didn't want to go with me because he thought I was too young. And I was a determined young lady, and I had looked at him and decided he was what I wanted. And I chased him till he caught me. You know, I later tried to give him away. I even called a girlfriend one day, an old girlfriend of his, that I had heard wanted him back, and I offered him back to her. And we had been married some 8, 9, 10 years by then, but I would have gladly given him to her. And she didn't want him, and I still got him. During the drinking, as I told you, I was crazy. But, you know, I did the best that I could do. I did all that I knew to do. And if somebody suggested something that sounded pretty good, I tried that too. He drank for the first 21 years of our marriage. And the last few years that he drank, he certainly did not let work interfere with his drinking. And our illness, and I say our illness because I firmly believe that alcoholism is a family illness. And although I've never drank nor smoked, I suffered from the disease of alcoholism. The three things that I did that people like to hear about, I do share. It took a while before I could share them honestly. And, you know, I think that I continue to grow in this program the longer I am here. And I think that taking my inventory, I do the best that I can today. Now, I realize the first time I took my inventory, it wasn't a real honest, thorough inventory, but I did the best that I could. The things that I'm going to share with you are funny to you today when you listen to them, and that's okay. But let me assure you of one thing. I was deadly serious. Because I didn't want to hurt anymore. You know, I had hurt and things had gone on. And I just wanted out. My father-in-law had died. And Cody is the youngest child in his family and the only boy. He has three older sisters. And they always felt like when they said jump, he should jump. And you know he did. And when I was single and living at home, I turned my life over to the care of my daddy because I was daresome to sass him. And the word why was not in our vocabulary. I was not allowed to ask why. And then when I married, I turned my life and my will over to the care of Herb. And again, I didn't ask why. I did whatever he wanted to do because, you see, I loved him just that much. I worshiped the ground that man walked on at that time. And so his family says move to South Georgia, so here we came to South Georgia. And our illness really begins at this point. And after being in South Georgia for a while, we moved to Alma. And we had bought a farm from his parents. And we bought a business, an office supply and printing store. Now, I've always been a hard worker, and we worked hard in this store, and he worked hard, too, and we prospered. And the more we prospered, the more he began to drink. And one day I said to him something about his drinking, and he looked at me, and he says, I don't hunt, and I don't fish, and I don't run around on you, and my hobby's drinking, and I'm going to drink. He felt he deserved it. I can't tell you exactly when I looked at him at a point in time and I said, I don't hunt, and I don't fish, and I don't run around on you, and my hobby's bitching. And I got as proficient in my hobby as he got in his. I want to talk about recovery because that's important to me, but the things that people like to hear, I will share too, not through ego or pride, but I just share it because you like to hear it, and it qualifies me for this program. I had worked, it was Thursday, and we were closed half a day on Thursday at the store, And I had worked and he had drank. And I went home and I was mad and he was drunk. And he got up out of his drunk bed and he says, "We're going to Hazelhurst." Well, I don't have a problem talking. And I told him that I had not lost anything in Hazelhurst. Didn't intend to find anything in Hazelhurst. And I didn't intend to go to Hazelhurst. And he backs up and stands up and he says, "We're going and you're going to drive." So I asked him why we was going. I think that's the first time I ever asked him why. And he said that we had a customer who needed some merchandise that we didn't have. And a office supply place in Hazelhurst had it, and we were going after it. We had a little Oldsmobile. We got in that Oldsmobile, and we were having one of our healthy discussions. And I believe, to the best of my memory, this is the first time this man told me that he wished he were dead. You know, it sounded good to me. And I wish you were dead, too. And I knew up ahead there was a bridge with the concrete railing. And so I thought, well, I'll just hit the bridge. And when I get angry, I drive fast. And I was going about 95 miles an hour. I remember looking down, and I was going to head toward the railing of the bridge. And just before I got there, I thought, well, you stupid fool. You're in this car, and what's going to happen if you hit that bridge? You're going to kill you and mangle him. And what the kid's going to have? A dead mama, a drunk daddy, and no insurance. And I swerved. Now, people tease me about insurance today. This is one of the character defects, if you want to call it that, that I have not been even a little bit willing to give up. When the insurance premium is due, I want it paid. And it does not matter to me where you pay it with a good check or a bad check. Just send the check. Because I used to reason out in my mind that if he just were to happen to die, and we had paid the insurance premium, that they could just deduct what I owed them from what they owed me, and I still think that makes good sense. To me. And when a premium comes in, I want it paid. I don't want it one day later. 30 minutes later, I want it there on time. So that's me and insurance. Time marches on, and I'm not going to tell y'all about all the hospitals that he went in and all the illnesses that he had, you know, the flu and kidney stones and gallbladder and, you know, all this mess. When it was actually alcoholism. He had a lot of good caretakers, and I was the best that he had. And time marches on, and it gets to be another Thursday, and I go home. I am so mad. And you see, by now, I don't have to get mad. That's my normal state of affairs, is being mad. And he's in the bed drunk. And he tells me in one of our discussions, again, that he wishes he were dead. And he said, you know, if I had a gun, I'd shoot myself. Well, now, my neighbors, I had excellent neighbors. They took care of my business, their business, anybody else's business that came along. And things had gotten so bad in my house that the neighbors and the children, see, my children are teenagers by now, they thought they had got all the guns out of the house because my children had lots of guns. And Daddy was drinking pretty heavy, and they was afraid that Daddy would get to drinking and he would hurt Mama in some of our healthy discussions. And I said, wait a minute. I know where there's a gun. And I went in my bathroom. I climbed up on a chair and reached on the back of a closet shelf. I got the gun and the bullets. That's the only gun I've ever loaded, but I loaded that one. I put it on the bed by him, put his hand on top of it, and said, now there's a gun, shoot yourself. All day long, I'd go by him and I'd look at him and I'd say, "You ain't shot yourself yet?" And now we have this discussion. Now this is an intelligent discussion between a mad woman and a drunk man. And he said, "No, you do it." And I said, "No, you do it, because it's got to be accidental, because your insurance is double indemnity." Because, you see, one of the things that I had done is I had gone to the sheriff of the county and asked him if Cody just happened to die, would he help me make it look like an accident? And you know that man agreed? I know today that he would have done anything to get me out of that office. And so at 11 o'clock, I'm getting tired, I'm getting sleepy, and I'm ready to go to bed. And I said, "Cody, are you going to shoot yourself?" I said, "If you would just get down on the floor, we got tile floors." I said, "You wouldn't bleed on my bed." And I could holler for Marvin. Marvin was the undertaker, who was just a block and a half down the street, to come get you, and you got on your white shirt, and we could just fold your arms, and you ready to go. And he said, "No, you do it." And I said, "No, you do it. You know, I'm tired. I want to go to bed. I'm ready to get this thing over with." And he refused, and I did, and I went down to the other end of the house and went to bed, and he didn't shoot himself, so that's how he didn't get shot. Thank God I was sick, but I wasn't that sick. I believe in blackouts, because from that day to this, I cannot remember past 11 o'clock that night. I do not know if that gun was ever seen again. I have no earthly idea. There are times in these things that I did that I can remember up to a certain point in that day, and I can't remember anymore. And I used to think, why don't I remember? And now I believe that for me, God's being good to me and not letting me remember. And that's okay. I can deal with it today. Time marches on and marches on, and it gets to be another Thursday. And I go home, and he's in his drunk bed. And he tells me again he wishes he were dead. And I remember very vividly, this is when I cuss. Now, for you who know me, know that I don't ordinarily say any cuss words. I just don't. But I looked at him and I said, "Yes, you son of a bitch, I want you dead, and I'm going to finish you off this day." And I knew where some strychnine was. You see, out at our farm, he had bought some strychnine and had put it in little pieces of hamburger meat and threw it out to some wild dogs because they were killing the calves. Well, I didn't mess with no hamburger meat. But I climbed up in my same little chair, in that same closet, on that same closet shelf, and I got that strychnine. And I went in and I poured it in a spoon. Now, I'm not going to tell y'all how to do it, but I've learned how to do it to kill them. And if you ever need it, just call me. But I had that little bottle of strychnine in one hand and the spoon in the other hand, and I'm saying, "Open your mouth." And he's shaking his head. Now, I did not have sense enough to put the strychnine down and force his mouth open. But I was just telling him to open your mouth, open your mouth. And the telephone rang. And it was the guy who worked for us, the printer. And he wanted me to come back to work. And I told him I just didn't have time to come back to work. And he said, "Well, Betty," he called me Buddy. He said, "Well, Buddy, I need you to come back to work." And I said, "I can't come back to work. I'm busy." And he said, "Well, what are you doing?" I said, "I'm killing Cody." And he said, "You're doing what?" And I said, "I'm killing Cody." And he said, "Why?" I said, "The son of a bitch wants to be dead, and I want him dead, and I'm finishing him off. I don't have time to talk to you anymore," and I hung up the telephone. Now, right diagonally across the street from us is the Baptist church. So he called the preacher And he said, Bob says, I think she's flipped her lid. He said, you can get across the street faster than I can get there. He said, you know, she's tried to kill him a couple of times. He says, will you go over there and see about her? So he comes trucking across the street, and he knocks on the front door. And I looked out my bedroom window, and I could see who was at the front door, so I just didn't go. In a few minutes, he came around, came in the back, and came in. And he came in the bedroom, and he said, what are you doing? Well, I felt by then I told all the county what I was doing. I said, I'm killing the son of a bitch. And he asked me why, and I told him he wanted to be dead, and I wanted him dead, and I was finishing him off that day. And he said, what you got? I said, strychnine. He said, give it to me. I said, open your mouth. I'd have give it to anybody at that point. But we struggled, and he got it. And he called a doctor friend of ours. And he said, Olin, I think you better come to Betty. She's flipping her lid. And Olin and his wife, Martha, came and stayed with us. And another lady came and stayed with us all that rest of that day and that night. If I moved, one of them moved. Cody was later privileged to work with the third person that came to the house. But Olin says that he felt like I had gone over the boundary line of sanity. And they were not afraid of what Cody would do, but they was afraid of what I would do to myself. So that's how he did not take strychnine, nor the preacher. And it was not long after that that the preacher left Bacon County. Those things are funny to hear. But when you're in a family of active alcoholism and you hurt, you know, you do all you know to do. And when somebody says they want to be dead, you think that's what they want, you know. Up until that point, I had never thought of killing myself, just getting rid of him, because you said we didn't have any insurance on me. And he goes in and out of hospitals, and in and out of hospitals. And I read one night in the paper about a man who was working with alcoholics. And I always talk about this man, and I'm honored today that he's in this room. He came to see me that night after 11 o'clock, and he remembers better than I do what went on. But I do know that this is when Al-Anon came into my life. Now, what he actually said to me, I don't know. But what I know that I heard was, if you'll go to Al-Anon, it will help his drinking. And anything that would help the drinking, I wanted part of. And besides, this man's a good-sized man. And he looked at me and he says, Annie, if you don't go, I will come get you and take you. When I was stupid, but I was not dumb. And I began to go to Al-Anon. For the next 18 months, I go. But I don't hear. I can identify with people who do not hear. I had the buddiness and the poor me's and the self-pities and the resentments and whatever else came along. I had a good case of. But I carried the body, and it took 18 months for the mind to follow, but I carried the body. At some point in here, and things, I'm never sure that I tell them in the order that they happened, but it's not important to you the order that they happened. It's just important to share my feelings and how I reacted. But he came to Statesboro, and this man who told me to go to Al-Anon, he and I and my youngest son brought Cody to Statesboro. And he had been here about a week, and he sent me word that he was going home. But now, as I've already told you, I didn't have to get mad. I stayed mad, and I was mad. And I sat down and I wrote him a letter. I told him who he was and who he wasn't, and what he was and what he wasn't, and where he could go if he left Statesboro. And it was not to Bacon County. I think this is when I really began to stand on my own two feet. And he stayed here. And it got time for the family visit. Melinda called, and I had met Melinda the night we came up. And she asked me about coming, and I told her no, didn't want any part of it, didn't intend to come. And she tried to talk to me, and I was not listening. And then Dr. John called me. Well, Dr. John was sort of like Jack, and he could put things in plain English that you had no problem understanding. And he told me where I could go and who I was and what I could do, and I damn sure better get to Statesboro. And I came. Well, he and Dot had a time with me. And one day, Dr. John sat me down in the corner of the TV room that we have now, and he says, "We gonna talk." Well, I don't know why he said, "We gonna talk," because that's the first time in my life he never let me say anything. He talked. But, you know, I think I began to listen. And we went home the next day, and Cub told me, he says, "I'm never going to drink like that anymore." Well, now, I took it to mean that he was not going to drink the next day. And he was drunk as a skunk by dinner time. So I decided that I'd practice some of the on program that they had been telling me about, and I took him to the doctor and got him a $15 shot. And he tells me that I resented that shot. It's why I remember the price of it so well, and I don't know whether I do or not, but I just do remember how much it cost. And I fixed him something to eat, and I bathed his brow, you know, and I did everything that I knew to do. I was as nice as I was capable of being at the time. And we got over that drunk. 2 weeks later, he was drunk again. And I thought, my friend, if drink is what you want to do, drink is what you're going to do. Because I had read in the paper about somebody dying from drinking too much. So I go to the liquor store, and me and the liquor owner had quite a discussion. He wouldn't sell me as much as I wanted to buy, but I bought 8 bottles. Smirnoff 100. We used to discuss what size they were. I can tell you how much I paid for them. I paid $32 and a dime with a bad check. And I took them home, and I lined them up, 4 in each row, 2 rows, and I called a lawyer. And I asked him, was it a legal death? Could they put me in jail if I gave him enough to drink till he died? Now, I keep this thing in the family. I call my sister-in-law's son-in-law. And he says, "Betty, you don't want to do that." And I said, "Yes, I do." He said, "You can't do that." I said, "You watch me." And he talked for a while, and I said, "This is my nickel. I'm calling long distance. Can they put me in jail?" And he said, well, he didn't think so, but he didn't think it was a wise thing to do, and I didn't care whether it was wise or not. So I began to offer Cody a drink. Had a little glass. I said, "You want a drink?" And he said, "Yeah." And I'd pour him some. When he got where he could not hold his head up, I held his head with one hand, that little shot glass with the other, and he drank it. Twice he asked for a drink of water. Twice I went to the kitchen, filled up a tea pitcher with ice cubes and water, carried it back in there, and turned it upside down in his face, and says, "Now there's your drink of water." He didn't ask for any more water, and I didn't give him any. He didn't ever take a chaser with his vodka. It was just straight vodka, and that's all he had. During the day, we had a good doctor who is in the program to come by. We had several other AAs to come by, and they'd say, "You're killing him." And I'd say, "That's right."
And they'd say, you can't do that. I said, he's mine. I do anything I want to. And I finally got everybody out, and I locked the doors, and there was not anybody in that house but me and Herbert Cody. He drank every drop in those 8 bottles. I know he did because I gave them to him. At 11 o'clock that night, people say he should have been dead. And I told him one time, I said, you know why you don't die? And he said, why? I said, God don't want you. The devil can't stand you. And they just leave you here to worry the stew out of me. So 11 o'clock that night, I said, Kay, you want another drink? And he said, oh, good God, no. The next morning, the first thing I asked him, do you want another drink? Oh, good God, no. He tells in his story that he did not want to be obligated to me. You know, his wanting to drink bad just didn't want to be obligated to me. He's obligated to me for 8 bottles. What would one more make? You know, what difference? But that was December the 10th of 1973, and thank God from that day to this, he has not had another drink. During the active drinking days, I had insisted that he take Anabuse, and he did. And he would take Anabuse, and he would drink, and he'd say, I'm dying, and I'd say, can you hurry? Can you hurry and do it? And one Friday night, we had been up all night long with him drinking, because when he was drinking, he didn't sleep, and you didn't sleep. The neighbors didn't sleep. They didn't nobody sleep. And about 6 o'clock that morning, I had gone to sleep. And I woke up around 7, and my youngest son was home. And I said, Steve, your daddy's gone. And he said, oh, Mama, he's just gone to get a bottle. It was Saturday morning. And I heard a car coming down our street. And I looked out the window. And Kay was trying to move a 100-year-old oak tree with a Chevrolet car. And it just doesn't work. The steering wheel was in the back seat. His hair was in the windshield. It just scalped him almost. Blood was everywhere. And by that time, the ambulance was there, and they said, he's dead. And I passed out, and I said then, and I'll say now, I don't know where it was from, relief or grief. But they carried us both to the same hospital. I stayed in Bacon County Hospital that day. They carried him on to White Cross. For the next 3 weeks, he stayed in intensive care, and I stayed in the hospital. 3 times, they came out and told me he could not possibly live but a few more hours and to call the family. The first 2 times, I called his sisters and I called our sons, and they came. And we walked the corridors and sat in the waiting room and, you know, all this kind of stuff that you do. But the 3rd time I said, no, I'm not going to call anybody. And I didn't call anybody, not the first soul. And you see, I had to pass my time away somehow. So I said, they tell me he's going to die, so I'll plan his funeral. And I had a little book in my pocketbook, and I wrote down who I wanted for pallbearers. And I had a time trying to decide. You know, and I decided what I wanted to say. It was going to be a very short funeral. Here he is, there he was, and yonder he goes. And I did not want him to point up or down, just go like that, you know. And that's all I wanted said. But he didn't die. And he stayed in the hospital for the next 3 months. Now, I stayed with him. And then I've had a lot of people to say why. And in taking my inventory, I had to ask myself why. Why did I stay? Well, I've already told you about that I'm a responsible person. And when a husband is critically ill, that's what society expects. And I had always done what was expected of me. I sometimes rebel now, but I didn't rebel then. And after he was moved out into a private room, I would look at him and I'd say, see what you've done to us? Because, you see, we didn't have a dime's worth of hospitalization, but we had multi-bucks and insurance, life insurance. If he would have just died, I would have been a very rich widow. And then I had to determine, I stayed because really deep down there was some love there for that man. Those reasons were okay for me in my first inventory when I began to get honest and serious about Al-Anon. And those reasons are okay with me today. So I've told you that I prayed for him to die. We did become active in AA and Al-Anon. Our family was split three ways because during the drinking days, my oldest son had said to me, "Mama, if you will stay in Alma, I will stay in Athens." Our youngest son, Cody and I separated for several weeks, I'm not even sure anymore. And our youngest son went with his daddy. And the middle son stayed with me. He said, "Mama, you do cook once in a while. Daddy doesn't." For the next 7.5 years, my youngest son had nothing to do with me, even after we began to get sobriety in our home. And I would ask my sponsor, when? And she'd say, "In God's time, in God's time." But, you know, I wanted to answer now, and I didn't get it. And when he did begin to talk to me, I told him one day, I said, "I wish that you loved me a tenth as much as you love your dad." And he's taller than I am, and he looked down at me, and he said, "I don't love you, but I respect you today." And you see, the program let me accept that, because I had hurt my son awful bad with my actions and my screaming and my hollering and my sickness. But I can stand before you today and tell you that this young man loves me today, and he tells me so. And he puts his arms around me and he calls me old woman, and he'll say, "Old woman, you're okay today." The first Christmas present that he gave me after he began to talk with me was a hug. That was more than money could buy. And the first time he told me he did love me, there again was the greatest gift that I could ever receive. We're a family today. We're a close-knit family today. Alcoholism gave me that. Alcoholism gave me a spiritual program. And you know, you think that on Sunday mornings you'd have spiritual speakers, and I know that I'm far from a spiritual speaker. But it gave me a spiritual program. It gave me a God of my understanding that I can live with today, that I'm comfortable with. A lot of things had happened after about 10 years of sobriety. And I thought I had a good program. I really thought I had a good program. I'm not going into detail with you about what happened, because to do that would hurt someone else, and that's not what I'm up here for. I'm up here to share with you my experience, my strength, my hope, and my love. But I began to hurt. And I'd go to Al-Anon, and they'd say, "You okay?" And I'd say, "I'm fine, I'm fine." I didn't share. Some of the things that I can share with you was that one of our sons was arrested for growing marijuana. Now, we don't do things in my family in a little way. This was acres of it. And so we stayed in court with that. I had a son who was getting a divorce, and it was a very ugly public child custody battle. Very ugly. And the judge awarded Cody and myself the children. One was just a baby in arms, and the other one was about 4 years old. And they lived with us for 3 years. But I still thought, "I'm doing okay. I'm doing okay." And then something else happened, and I was asked one time in a workshop, and this has stuck with me ever since. If you think that you've reached your limit or something that you just could not live with happened, what would you do? And I used to say I'd leave, because by now my parents are dead and his sister's gone and most of the family's away. We just have them every now and then. But you see, the worst thing that I thought that could happen to me happened. And I almost lost my mind. I couldn't do anything but cry. And I would cry. And Dr. Chuck came to the house and he told me one day, he said, if you will work in your program. And I screamed at him to the top of my lungs and I said, I'm working the damned old program to the best of my ability. And it wasn't long after that I felt I could not live anymore. I've been doing a lot of thinking about this, and I think that it's not that I thought so much about killing myself, because sleep is an escape for me. I just wanted to go to sleep and not wake up and not hurt anymore. And I attempted to do this. And a friend of mine found me, and she called Chuck, and he came to the house. And after they revived me, Chuck says, what are you going to do? And I told him, I'm going to call Dot. And I did. And she says, can you be here by 5? And I was. And she took one look at me and she says, well, I don't need you. I'll take you home with me. And she took me home with her. She gave me the most loving, tender care. She gave me the most firm care. Other members of the family came by and talked to me, the nurses, the housekeeper. And she said to me something that I hope I never forget as long as I live. Become teachable. Because you see, I had stopped becoming teachable. I had been in the program long enough that I thought I knew an awful lot. And I did become teachable, I'm grateful to say, and I did just exactly what she told me to do, when she told me to do it, and how she told me to do it. And I'm grateful for this woman that saved my life. Sometimes my sanity is in question, but my life is not. My husband did not have a job, and we had no money. We had sold our farm and sold our business. And we had talked about getting into the counseling field, not even knowing that it would ever be possible. It was a dream. And we moved to Atlanta, Georgia. This young man, that had not spoken to me for years, had an apartment there, and he said, y'all come to Atlanta, look for jobs, and live with me. And he gave me a job, and we sat down and talked about it, and the way that we could work that out was from 8 o'clock in the morning to 5 o'clock in the afternoon, he was Mr. Cody, and it was yes, sir, and no, sir. And from 5 o'clock on, I was Mama. And you know, that worked for us. But at a later time, we moved to Macon. We waited till we got old to start moving around. And while we were in Macon, Cody was supposed to go in for some minor surgery. And they found out that if they put him to sleep, he would probably die. I'd been told this many times, you know, too. And before it didn't bother me, but this time I prayed that he would live. And they did emergency surgery and did 5 bypasses. But you see, I was not by myself. I had AA, I had Al-Anon, and I had my family. They were all there. And we were all praying for life, not death. Then later on, we got an opportunity to move to Statesboro, and that was a dream come true for me. I tried a little too hard when I first got here, and I made a lot of mistakes. Still make a lot of mistakes today. But I don't think there's a human in the world that loves their job any more than I do. Because, you see, I talk to these sick family members, and I can say to them, I understand. I understand where you're coming from, because I've been there. And I can share with them experience, strength, and hope, and most of all, love, because we feel so unlovable. I know that the alcoholic feels unlovable, but so does the family members. Today, I'm okay in my skin. Mistakes and all, I'm okay in my skin. I'm a fairly happy person today, and I'm grateful for that. There's a lot that I've left out. You know, there's just no way that you can get up here and in 1 hour tell about 21 years of drinking and your reactions. There's not any way that I can tell you about all the fusses and the fights. And he never abused me. I was the one that slapped him around. And I did do that. He quoted the Bible at me one time, and he's never done that again. He said, the Bible says, turn the other cheek. And I had slapped one cheek, and he said that to me, and he turned his head like that, and I slapped that side too. But I don't have to do that anymore. I don't have to do that. I shared at a workshop last week, or whenever it was, that I had gotten so angry I slammed the kitchen door bad enough to crack the glass in the door. And, you know, I don't get that angry very often anymore, and I'm glad of that because I've got a temper like you would not believe. It's been a long time since I've thrown anything. I don't have to today. Recovery has come hard. I have not learned anything easy in this program, but thank God it's come. I'm going to share this with you, and then I'm going to sit down and shut up. But I never felt loved. One of the things I did not tell you this morning was that in growing up, I was an unwanted child. And I know that I was an unwanted child because my mom would tell me so. You see, I have this knack of making people angry. I guess that's one of the best gifts I've got. And I would make Mama mad, and she would shake me, and she'd say, I don't love you, I did not want you, and I wish you had never been born. And Cody does not tell me he loves me. He just does not utter those words, and I never felt loved. I did not know how to give love because I didn't know how to take love. But today, I believe that I am capable of giving and accepting love. It's just been within the last few years that I've really been able to accept when people say, I love you, and to think that they mean it. And to feel that they believe, that they mean it. Because you see, I couldn't feel that before. And this program has given me that feeling. I joke. And I carry on. And I cut foolishness an awful lot. But AA and Al-Anon are the two most important things in my life. Over and above my family. Because without those two programs, I wouldn't have a family. And I know today where my priorities are. I'm going to do something else that I've never done before. The three people in this room that have literally saved my life, I'm going to ask him to say it. Jack, would you stand? Dot? and her. Jack, you're special, and I always say that you're special, but you're usually not with me when I'm talking. Thank you from the bottom of my heart for putting me on the road to life. Dot, you've heard me many times. You could tell my story better than I can. There's nothing about me that this woman does not know. Nothing. I've shared with her my deepest hurts, my deepest thoughts. Thank you, Dot, for giving me my life. Herb, I do love you. Thank you for staying with me when you didn't need to. Thank you.